Welcome to Health and Veritas. I'm Harlan Krumholz.
And I'm Howie Foreman. We're physicians and professors at Yale University trying to get closer to the truth about health and healthcare. We're excited to welcome Professor Zach Cooper today. But first, we always like to check in on whatever the hot topics in health and healthcare are. So Harlan, tell us what's going on.
I don't know. There's so much going on, Howie.
Yeah.
But one of the things that caught my eye this week was Hippocratic AI. Have you heard of that?
Only because you brought it up to me recently, but no, I have not heard about it. It's come out of nowhere. You know,
it's kind of the most recent darling of the generative AI programs focusing on health. So this group, which has been, you know, sort of in stealth mode for a long time, is just came out this week and talked about how they raised another $53 million from venture firms like General Catalyst, and they already had participation from Andreessen and others. For now, a valuation that hits $500 million, but they actually have no customers yet. They're mostly in, you know, in a mode where they're coming out of stealth and are testing a product. And what's interesting is that this product that they're talking about, it's called Polaris. It came out in a preprint. And you know, these preprints are basically anyone can post something. There's no peer review to it yet. And basically what they're saying is that they're trying to put together something that can actually get involved in long-term conversations. Sometimes I think about these as chatbots, but voice conversations with patients. They're going to address some of the issues that we're facing around shortage of medical personnel. So they're saying like, look, we're lacking nurses in the healthcare ecosystem, and we're going to try to put together a system that's going to be able to replace nurses. Now, you and I both know that one of the issues with generative AI and these, you know, the ChatGPTs or the Google Gemini or the Anthropic Claude, which, you know, they just came out with their third version, is that although they are amazing, and I think they're amazing, they also can be prone to confabulate. They can produce results that aren't correct. It's almost like they're dreaming. They're so creative, they become untethered from the truth. So people have been concerned about this in healthcare that okay, these may be good for some tasks that have a lot of oversight, but can you really actually put them out into the wild and let them interact with patients in ways that are unsupervised because they're so safe that they work? I don't know. What do you think about that?
No, I worry about all of this. And quite frankly, Harlan, look, you're the one who introduced this to me a couple of years ago where you started raising concerns and I started doing more reading. I do worry a lot about that. And it's why the best use cases are areas where it is an assistive technology to physicians or other providers, as opposed to what you're describing, where they really are artificial intelligence engaging with patients. And we will not have enough data on that for years to feel confident in that. And I'm hopeful that the FDA actually realizes that as well.
So it is a real moonshot. There's no question about it. And they are trying to put in place, you know, guardrails within this, how they're pre-training the system. I mean, one of the things that's interesting to me is when you get these companies that come out and say, we're going to pre-train, we're going to prepare these models based on a lot of input of medical information. I find it interesting because when I'm interacting, for example, with ChatGPT, and I use a lot of them all the time I use them to help me in work, but because I'm curious about them, they're darn good at medical stuff. I mean, anyone should try them. I mean, you know, ask them anything. They were darn good. So I wonder how much better they can be and how much safer they can be. But this is their whole point. They contend that they're going to be able to produce a very safe product. I just want to give you some examples in this preprint, though. What I thought was very interesting was the way in which they, you know, were sort of testing them. And I thought this was interesting because they're also looking at whether or not they can create these interactions such that they're not only accurate, but they're empathic. So, for example, they say, you know, they've got one interactions with a patient where actually what they're doing is trying to build rapport with the patient.
Right, exactly.
So they start just talking about like, hey, how are you doing? Before we dive into topics, I'd like to get to know you a little better. Is there anything you're looking forward to doing this week? The patient, by the way, these patients were in many cases nurses who were acting as patients, then they were able to generate these interactions. Then they had real nurses acting with patients, and then they had nurses and doctors judging the quality of the interactions. But, you know, the patient says, I'm looking forward to a little gardening. It's something I love. And then the computer says, that sounds wonderful, George. Gardening can be indeed very therapeutic. blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they go on in a whole conversation that's simply rapport building. And I thought that's quite interesting. They had another example, by the way, where they were demonstrating how they could sort of let people off the hook. There was an interaction that was going on where someone said, I'm embarrassed, but I haven't been able to take all my meds, or I can't quite remember the example, but it was something like they were embarrassed that they weren't able to do something. And the computer had been, you know, I see this on ChatGPT too, had been put in a position where it was, you know, saying, you don't need to be embarrassed. Don't worry. You know,
Yeah, it's crazy.
That's understandable. You know, that happens to people in a way that I thought was very appropriate and good. So there's all these examples in this preprint. We'll put a link to it in the thing. People should know, again, this is the company producing the results of studies that they did. But what was interesting in this preprint also, I'll just end with this, Howie, because there's so much that I could get into. But when you looked at the comparison of, for example, nurses evaluating the computer, doctors evaluating the computer, and nurses evaluating nurses. So they're sort of trying to get to this thing. In almost every case, the machine scored higher. And we've seen this before in other studies.
You've brought it up in prior podcasts. Yeah, it's more empathic.
More empathic. So when people are evaluating these areas. But these are more longer-term conversations than short-term texts that are going on. But anyway, let's stay tuned to this. I mean, this is, again, it's a moonshot. It is a long shot, but this field is moving so fast, and there's lots of capital being deployed.
That's for sure.
Yeah, they've raised about $120 million so far, so $500 million valuation on $120. But yeah, we'll see what happens.
Many of these companies will fail, but we do root for them. We want them to succeed. We just don't know which ones will be.
But the world's changing. Yes, it's changing fast.
Yep.
Hey, Howie, let's get on to our interview with Zach.
Zach Cooper is an associate professor of public health and of economics at Yale University. Additionally, he serves as the director of health policy at Yale's Institution for Social and Policy Studies. As a health economist, Cooper's work focuses on topics ranging from the impact of competition in the insurance market to the influence of electoral politics on healthcare spending. In 2021, Cooper co-launched the 1% Steps for Healthcare Reform Project, which highlights tangible ways in which small changes in the healthcare system can accumulate to as much as $400 billion in savings each year. His investigations tackle the most challenging topics of the day, but more than that, he's not just shining a light on problems, he also has actively supported efforts to solve them, as we'll talk about today. Zach Cooper received his undergraduate degree from the University of Chicago and his PhD from the London School of Economics, after which he joined us. And first of all, I just want to welcome you to the podcast. One of the fun things about doing the podcast is to get a little backstory. And I don't think I've ever asked you about even where you grew up or how you came to be interested in health policy. So I'd love to start off with that topic and how you came to this.
Well, totally. And Harlan and Howie, thanks for having me. Howie, you have like a radio voice. You sound so professional on that
you
intro.
You are lying, but thank you.
No, I am not. So the background, I was born in New York, ended up growing up mostly in Vermont, and grew up as a ski racer. So I went to one of these high schools that you sort of almost can't believe exists in the U.S. It was a high school for winter sports athletes. And so I did that. I had no intention of doing anything other than skiing. And it turns out it just wasn't very good. I ended up actually we were talking about the ER before. I ended up with a compartment syndrome, which for any non-MD out there who's listening is, shall we charitably say, not pleasant. And, you know, that was
potentially limb-threatening.
This was a bad day at the office. And, yeah, we talked about that too, but I ended up, it sort of squandered the last year I was racing. And so I ended up going to college, and I went to a small school that had a really good ski team for a year. And, you know, I did Division I skiing, and I was skiing slowly and not going to class. And I sort of couldn't figure out, you know, why I was doing it. And it's an awesome story. I ended up applying to transfer. And a lot of places I wanted to transfer to had ski teams. And I didn't think that was a great idea. I thought it was going to potentially sort of pull me back. And so I went to the place that had the least opportunity to ski, and that was the University of Chicago. And so I got in as a transfer student, and I got a call from a guy named Ted O'Neill, who was the admissions director. And he said, look, we're going to let you into transfer, but I don't think this is the right place for you. This is a pretty nerdy place. You basically didn't go to high school, and we don't want somebody who's going to end up like transferring twice. That's not the best thing for you. So he's like, come on out, visit. Turns out Ted had a really soft spot for athletes. He was a Division I football player. And I got there and fell in love with the university and got crushed my first year. It was not a pretty 9 months in my first year, but sort of really found my way. And so when I came back to, when I started at Yale, you know, my office is right next to the admissions office at Yale. And I sent Ted a note and I said, you know, very rarely you sort of meet one or two people in your life who fundamentally change the arc of your life. And he's one of those people. Like, if I hadn't gotten into the University of Chicago, I don't know what I'd be doing, but I certainly
would not. That's a great story.
I ended up in grad school, and I told him I look at the admissions office every day, and I think of him. And you know, one of the coolest things about, you know, being at Yale is we have this thing called the Eli Whitney Scholars Program, which is a program for non-traditional students. And you know, I wasn't non-traditional in the timing sense, but I really did not look like the modal person who ended up at U of C. And so I've really supported two folks who've come through the Eli Whitney Scholars Program. One is my best friend, a guy named James Hatch, who's the oldest undergrad at Yale. He's 56 and graduating this year. And then a young fellow named Xavier Zayat, who I raced motorcycles with. So he was a guy who I knew through motorcycle racing, who ended up making a big pivot in his life too. So that's like the sort of roundabout way I ended up. So I went to U of C, wanted to go to be a doctor. And so did that whole med school route. I took organic chemistry, which nobody should ever have to do. Took the MCATs, which nobody should ever have to do. And then I got the chance to go to England, and I was going to go back to med school after. But ended up doing my master's there in health economics, econ. And it just seemed like it was sort of the right place. And so I said no to med school and have been jealous of people like you and Harlan ever since. And 7 years later, came back here.
I definitely would love if you could give just 2 minutes on your Eli and Whitney student, because that story is a very compelling story, even if it's unrelated to healthcare, or at least directly.
Totally. I mean, I think Yale, look, I love the university. And, you know, I think the Eli Whitney Scholars Program is one of the real gems of the university. And one of my good buddies was the troop commander for this group called SEAL Team 6, which is this sort of really unique, pretty high speed military unit. And he and I knew each other really well. And one of his teammates had gotten shot. So he had been on a mission. Their group does some pretty weird stuff. So one of the things they do are hostage rescue missions. And they'd gone out to rescue this guy named Bo Bergdahl, who's this American private who had wandered off his base. And on the mission, this fellow, Jimmy Hatch, got shot, ended up needing, I think, something like 20 surgeries, and, you know, had some real challenges afterwards, you know, with PTSD and just sort of dealing with, you know, pretty abrupt shift in his life. And yeah, he was sort of on the mend, and I lost a bet, actually, with my friend. And the bet was that if, I don't remember what we were betting over, but if I lost, I had to go skydiving. And so it ended up down in Virginia, where these guys are stationed. And it turns out this guy, James, is an amazing skydiver. And so we all met up and went skydiving, and we hit it off. He was remarkable, hugely cerebral, thoughtful, and became amazingly good friends. And he was really starting to find his way. He had just finished a book about mental health and his journey. And I was sort of asking what he was going to do. He was, yeah, maybe 48 at the time, 49, and had a lot of life ahead of him. And he didn't really know. And I said, you know, you ever thought about going back to college or going to college? and didn't give much thought. I said, what about Yale? And I never think about that. So we brought him up to campus. I was teaching a class with Jim Levinson, who runs Jackson at the time. And Jimmy sat in it and actually ended up sort of running through some of the examples with us and then took him to a couple of the classes. And it was this sort of this moment in the Davenport dining hall that I think in many ways shows what Yale's all about. You know, he said to me something like, you know, I didn't go to Phillips Exeter, or I didn't go to Deerfield, I don't belong here. There was a young woman sitting next to us, and I said, hey, can I just ask you a question? She said, sure. I was like, where are you from? Los Angeles. I said, do you mind if I ask a personal question? No. I said, what do your parents do? So my dad drives a taxi and my mom's a cleaner. And you could see sort of Jimmy's jaw drop. And it was sort of this idea that the university wasn't what he thought it was. And he applied, got in, and it's been awesome. So I get to have my best friend in town, and I get to watch him getting, you know, crushed as he did direct studies and, you know, navigates Herodotus, and I get to see him give back to Yale and benefit from it.
Thanks for sharing that. Early on, when you started tackling surprise billing, I think there was a community of emergency medicine doctors who thought you were sort of attacking them. But it really, over time, it became much more obvious this is just a big problem, and that while emergency medicine may be one big part of it, they're not the only part of it. Can you talk about, number one, because this is a great story of start to finish, number one, what the problem is, number two, how you've shone a light on it, and then number three, like what type of solutions have already been implemented because of your work, and really specifically your work.
Totally, and y'all interrupt me, right? I can go sure. on, so you know, push back, and we'll take the conversation in as many directions.
No, but this is a great story and an example where you actually changed national policy. Yes. I think it's worth talking about.
No, I'm grateful to get the chance at it. So. I was reading an article actually by Libby Rosenthal, who's a writer. She was at the Times then, now is at Kaiser, and it was telling the story of a guy named Craig Hopper. I literally remember the guy's name because it had that big an impact on me. Guy went to an in-network hospital in an emergency and ended up getting treated by an out-of-network physician. And for folks listening, it's sort of one of these weird features of the U.S. health system. Doctors work in hospitals don't necessarily participate in the same networks as the hospital where they work. And you know, this guy goes to an in-network hospital, sees an out-of-network doctor, gets a bill for, you know, whatever it was, $1,200. And you know, the thing that really grounds me a lot is putting that number in context. And half the country doesn't have $400 in a checking account. So you know, getting a bill that you didn't expect and couldn't avoid for $800, that's a bad day for the majority of Americans. And so I wanted to figure out how often this was happening, right? If it was one in a million, it sounds callous, but the solution's GoFundMe page. But if it's something that's more common, we've got a policy problem. And so I went on the hunt for data, and that was not easy. It took a long time to get folks to agree to give me the data. And I was working out with Fiona Scott Morton, who's a colleague at SOM. And I remember we first got under the hood, and we just looked at the data, and we saw that one in four patients who went to an in-network hospital were treated by an out-of-network emergency room physician. And it was one of those, oh, you know what moments. Like, wow, this is way higher than I thought. And you know, we put this in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it, you know, got a fair bit of traction. And in the coverage of it, there was a person at the American College of Emergency Physicians, Becky Parker, she was the president at the time, and had a quote at the end that basically accused Fiona and I of you know, data fraud. I was like, wow, that's aggressive. Like, what in the world is that all about? And I got a note a couple days later from another emergency physician who said, oh, you know, I think you should know her day job is actually the executive vice president of this company called Envision Healthcare, or MCARE. And MCARE is the largest physician staffing company, or was. It actually went bankrupt pretty recently. But was the largest employer of emergency room physicians in the U.S. And long story short, they had a business model that was basically to buy emergency room physicians and strategically take them out of network. And so I had another paper that really looked very specifically at them. It showed that when they came in, all the physicians went from in-network to out-of-network. They got much higher payments. And then we tested a policy proposal or policy package in New York that basically banned out-of-network billing and introduced a process through which physicians and insurance companies could settle their disputes, and showed that this really, for all intents and purposes, eliminated patients' out-of-pocket costs and actually lowered in-network rates. And, you know, our papers come out. One of the things that I do a lot with our work, because I really do want impact, is I try to collaborate with or work with journalists to tell the story. And we were really fortunate that the New York Times decided to cover it. It was the lead story on the front page, and the title was "The Company Behind Surprise Medical Bills." And it turned out it was that company and one called Team Health. Paper came out. It got a decent amount of traction. And over the next 24 months, I probably took 15 trips to D.C. Lamar Alexander was a senator, retiring, but sort of took this as really a last issue he wanted to tackle, push through legislation. President Trump, to his credit, I think he's got a sort of a bit of evil genius for sort of populist things. And this was one of the things that actually, you know, similar to drug pricing, where I think he actually did some good work, got a sense of this is something that really was affecting people and supported it. It was one of these rare bipartisan moments. And it was 2021, I think, they passed the No Surprises Act, which basically took what happened in New York, scaled it across the country. And it's been imperfect, but as I said to the Washington Post not long ago, you know, there are millions of people now who aren't getting surprise medical bills. And so even if the law has some warts, it's a good thing.
Well, and I think this is a way to inspire people at academia, you know, especially on the applied research. I mean, the basic science side, of course, are unlocking secrets of the universe, God bless. But on the applied side, really, our work should be making change, making things better. We should be identifying areas that we can improve. And I think no one does it better than you do. It just, you know, and I think you're I don't know the extent that you can allude to, but some of your more recent work is going to focus really on what the consequences of the increasing healthcare costs are on economy, wages, and a whole range of other areas that people don't always take into account when they look at rising healthcare costs.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of talk broadly about it. You know, it's the sort of question is, you know, and it's a central theme in a lot of my work, which is who's paying and who's benefiting from the healthcare system and how are they paying? And I think too often what happens is the folks who are really the most affected are often the most vulnerable. And the folks who benefit the most are often at the top of organizations. So we can think a little bit about the theory of who pays for rising healthcare costs. We think it comes out of labor markets. So we think that when the cost of healthcare rise, that results in lower wages. The challenge is it's really hard to lower somebody's wages, right? We all have, employees. I can't just go to a research assistant and say, I'm going to pay it 10% less, Right. Certainly not in the short run. And so if I say, the cost of employing somebody because, the insurance premiums at Yale go up, what I can't do is lower their pay. What I can do is probably let one person go or not hire another person. And so that's what the theory suggests. Moreover, the theory suggests the people you're probably going to see getting letting go are lower skilled, lower wage workers. And so that's something that we're spending a bunch of time now looking at. And it's been a heavy lift. We're working with two amazing economists at the Treasury, looking at the universe of tax returns. I thought healthcare claims data were a pain. It turns out everyone's tax returns and the sort of mountains and complexity of that are the only thing that's been more complicated.
And just for our listeners, that access to tax returns is, first of all, incredibly privileged and all de-identified so that you're not aware of any individual taxpayer's tax returns, just so they understand that.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. We actually don't even work with the data. So the data's, the IRS rightly takes this incredibly seriously. So we write code and then, we send it over to folks at the Treasury who run it. And, I think the Treasury has done an amazing job using their research to sort of shed light on the economy. So there's work by Raj Chetty up at Harvard that looks at inequality. There's been folks who've done amazing work about sort of who pays how much in taxes. I mean, so it's one of the sort of crown jewels, I think, of research data sets in the U.S.
As we get to the end, I want to ask quickly, because you spent time in the U.K., you studied at Oxford, I'm curious to hear you. Harlan and I have talked about it on the podcast. Curious to hear your view on not the political reality, but what you think about National Health Service of England versus what we have here, and what are the balance? What are the balance of conclusions you come to about that?
So I guess the way I think about it when people ask me, I say my views on the U.S. One's views about sort of the healthcare in the U.S. versus healthcare in England very much depend on who you are. So if I were unemployed, if I wasn't fortunate to have some of the opportunities I have, undoubtedly I'd rather be in England. The care is excellent. Cost is never a barrier to access. Often the way they limit who gets what is through waiting times. In the U.S., I think if you're really fortunate, you can jump the queue in a lot of ways. You can sort of buy your way out of problems. That has some huge upsides, right? And I think particularly on the acute care side, the outcomes here often are a little bit better if you can get access to care. So I guess my sort of big takeaway from the NHS is I think it's a remarkable institution that faces really tough issues with being sort of financially solvent, with keeping up with the pay needs of their staff, but at its best offers world-class care that doesn't price anybody out. And I think that's pretty darn good. I don't think it fits in the US, so I think it is not realistic in any number of ways, not least of which politically, to sort of take it and spread it here.
That's where I come down on it also.
Yeah. And look, I think the other is, it's a lot. You could introduce potentially, we tried to introduce single payer in Vermont and that didn't happen. It's really hard in a country as big as the U.S. to have one health system and to run it ostensibly by a command and control.
I want to say how much I value you as a friend. I want to say that we're still lucky to have you as a colleague and that this work is just had such tangible impact on Americans. And by the way, the world looks to what goes on here. So I want to thank you, Zach. You're an exemplary teacher also. You inspire people around you. And it's a privilege to have you on the program.
Yeah.
And I say the same back to both of you guys. So it's a blast to be here with you. And you and I have a paper together. We even get the chance to write. So it's good fun.
I got to see the magic happen.
Thanks very much, Zach. Thanks for joining us.
Yep, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Well, that was a terrific interview. And I could listen to Zach forever. I mean, he's doing such important research and he's also just so articulate about it. I just love listening to him. Hey, so Howie, let's get to what I always say is my favorite part of the show.
That's you. So March 24th, for all of our listeners who don't know it, is World Tuberculosis Day. I spent the last few days brushing up on this deadly disease and why we should talk about it today. It remains the second leading cause of infectious disease death in the world after COVID-19. 1.3 million people dying annually, mostly in low and middle income countries. 13% of these were people living with HIV. Nearly 11 million people had tuberculosis in that same year, and it disproportionately is affecting poorer people and those who are immunocompromised. We'll come back to that. The reality is that 1 in 4 people in the world has actually been infected with the mycobacterium that causes tuberculosis, but only a small percentage actually get disease. So it is a difference between who gets exposed, who actually gets infected, and then who gets tuberculosis itself. So while we can continue to improve the social determinants that put people at risk for the disease through better housing and increased access to resources, we can do a lot through public health and healthcare too. For comparison, in the United States, 70% of cases are in non-US born individuals, often because they are the most impoverished and live in close quarters where transmission from someone with disease is easier, and because they include many at-risk populations. TB is 6 times more likely in patients with HIV, and the other known risk factors are diabetes, malnourishment, and tobacco use. So just this week, the World Health Organization released a report making the business case for aggressive screening and treatment for tuberculosis or infection in four countries, Brazil, Georgia, Kenya, and South Africa. They highlight evidence-based approaches to screen people at high risk for developing tuberculosis, treating those who have it, because they point out 29% of those who actually have tuberculosis don't even know they have it and they don't get treated, and also treating those who don't necessarily have it but are at high risk for getting it. They show that the return on investment for these public health programs is phenomenal. Net savings in all the countries from a societal perspective. In South Africa, where the return on investment is greatest, there is a 39 US dollar return for every $1 spent from a societal perspective. But as with so much in public health, this is easier said than done. This needs to be an investment from public and or private dollars, and making the business case is only the first step. Gains from this program do flow to individuals, but the business case makes clear that it's the overall society benefits that we need to be able to consider here. Getting the collective to provide the resources for such programs is not always easy. But in a year where you and I have already talked about public health successes aimed at eradicating the guinea worm globally and malaria in Cabo Verde, the prospect of eradicating tuberculosis is not so far-fetched. In fact, the WHO has set 2035 as a target for eradicating 90% of cases and 95% of deaths. Now, that sounds like a lot, but for what it's worth, deaths due to TB are down 94% in the United States since 1960. So this is not pie in the sky. This is achievable. At least I really hope so.
I'm so glad you shared that. What a great piece of news on the cusp of World Tuberculosis Day. I was thinking about that too. When I was in training, you know, we would talk about tuberculosis. Of course, you know, I know this. I do this clinic with the medical students, the Haven Clinic, and there's a lot of screening also going on there. Some latent TB is found. I'm always amazed and treated, but it's a success story. But like you said, we're not done yet. And really, it's like this last mile. Maybe it's longer than a mile, but it could be done.
It can be done.
Yeah. What a remarkable achievement it would be.
Yep.
You've been listening to Health and Veritas with Harlan Krumholz and Howie Foreman.
So how did we do? To give us your feedback or to keep the conversation going, email us at health.veritas@yale.edu or follow us on LinkedIn, Threads, Twitter, or wherever you find us.
We very much want to hear your feedback, questions, or your own experiences with these topics. We're interested in engaging with our audience. And if you like the podcast, or if you even don't, just rate us and review us. The feedback is always helpful to us. We always read the reviews. And it helps other listeners to find us.
And if you have questions about the MBA for Executives program at the Yale School of Management, reach out via email for more information or check out our website at som.yale.edu/EMBA.
Health and Veritas is produced at the Yale School of Management, the Yale School of Public Health. Thanks to our researchers, Inez Giel and Sophia Stump, Yale students who are simply amazing, and to our producer, Miranda Schaefer, who makes this place sound great every week.
They are amazing. Thank you very much to all of them. Talk to you soon, Harlan.